Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Let others obsess only on the horse race. We continue now with the Brian Lehrer Show's election series. 30 issues in 30 days. Issue 12, Wall Street and You. It's part of our week-long focus this week on inequality in America as an overriding issue in the presidential race. And we have a very special guest to begin this hour, Sheila Bair. She was Assistant Treasury Secretary in the Bush administration and then appointed by President Bush to head the FDIC when the subprime mortgage crisis started to become apparent. She became one of the biggest hawks on dealing with the banks under either Bush or Obama. She stayed on and became a dissident within the Obama administration as a result. Sheila Bair has a book called Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street and Wall Street from Itself. Ms. Bair, it's an honor to have you on the show. Welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Let me begin here, if I might. Our guest yesterday, Robert Shiller from the Case Shiller Housing Index, said inequality contributed to the financial crisis because the rich were accumulating wealth while the middle class was accumulating debt. I'm curious how much you agree with that.
Well, I do agree with that. I think we shifted to an economy that was based on wide availability of credit to fuel consumer spending, and that's really what drove our economic growth. And that wasn't a sustainable model. And the consumer spending, in turn, was based heavily on building home equity in your house, not through paying down your mortgage, which is the traditional way, but through home prices going way up. We had a significant housing price bubble that popped, and the problems are apparent and painful and continue to this day. So I absolutely agree with that. We didn't focus on job creation, better jobs, better education to improve the quality of living. We relied on cheap credit, and it was not a sustainable model.
And Shiller quoted somebody who called this a deliberate policy of let them eat debt during the Bush and Clinton years.
That's good. I hadn't heard that, but that's good.
Because wealthy people in the banking industry, the theory goes, got more and more influential in Washington to tilt policy. And I'm curious how much you agree with that.
Well, I absolutely agree with that. The thing that was so frustrating about the subprime crisis is that it could have been so easily avoided with a couple of common sense measures. For one, having lending standards that applied to both banks, traditional banks, as well as non-bank mortgage brokers and other entities who were involved in originating these very toxic mortgages. The Fed refused to do it. The Fed had authority. The Fed refused to do it. Congress had the ability, but industry lobbying stymied efforts in Congress to get mortgage lending bills through. So that's a good, you know, prime example of where Washington just started seeing the world through the eyes of financial institutions, the financial industry, and it absolutely skewed policy and I think continues to do so.
And listeners, if you want to talk to Sheila Bair, former chairman of the FDIC, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You write in the book about how shocked you were when you were appointed as FDIC chairman in 2006 to see the extent of the risk that banks were taking on subprime mortgages. Can you describe what you saw and your reaction to it?
Right. Well, we had I became chairman in June of 2006, and the FDIC staff were already on top of this. They had, our economists had been monitoring it. I authorized acquisition of a database that told us what loans inside these private label securitizations look like. Part of the problem, one of the reasons it was hard to see the risk building, was because these were not loans that traditional banks originated and held on their balance sheet. Most of them were being originated outside of the banking sector. Some banks did it too, but most of it was done outside the traditional banking sector and sold into the securitization trusts, pooled and sold, and then sold off to investors. The interest in these trusts sold off to investors. So we had to buy data to actually see what was going on. And when we did, it was frightening. Very high debt-to-income ratios. So the mortgage payment as a percentage of the gross income of the borrower frequently exceeded 50%. Very little income documentation. Very steep payment resets. These subprime loans were very abusive loans. The starter rate would be 9, 10, 11%, and then it would jump up to by 3 or 4 percentage points after the initial period of 2 or 3 years. So they were designed to continually force the borrower to refinance because the borrower could not make the payment reset. And so that just generated a whole new round of fees for the originators. And there's a saying in the industry called "I'll be gone, you'll be gone." And basically the idea was they would just originate any kind of loan, no matter how abusive or how poorly documented, and sell it off to investors because they were going to be long gone by the time the loan started getting into trouble. So it was shocking what we saw. It really was.
So that's a little bit of how we got there. And then you write in the book that in retrospect, the bank bailouts were overly generous because most of the money really went to softening the impact to their bottom lines, not preventing their actual failures. How much did it look that way to you at the time?
Well, I think the capital investments, I think the only two institutions that I think were really clearly insolvent that got the original TARP infusions were Citigroup and Merrill Lynch. Now, Merrill Lynch had arranged to sell itself to Bank of America, and that later created problems for Bank of America. But Citigroup, the capital markets were closed completely to it, and it really did need government capital to stay solvent. The rest of them were solvent. They were having liquidity problems, especially the investment banks, Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. They relied heavily on their funding by going to the debt markets and continually borrowing money, short-term money, to fund their operations. And those credit markets dried up during the crisis. The traditional commercial banks were in a little better shape because they had insured deposits, which were sticky. Those were stable sources of funding. So we probably did need to provide some liquidity support on a temporary basis, but I think Citigroup is really the only one who needed a capital infusion to stay solvent. And then, of course, we provided a lot of other trillions of dollars of lending programs through the Fed. The theory, I think it was well-intentioned, was that if you got the banks in good shape, they were going to lend and support the real economy. But it just didn't work out that way, let's face it. And I think Washington and a lot of the bailout policies in both the Bush and Obama administration confused what is good for banks and what makes them profitable, which is good for the broader economy. And they're just very different things.
And you write about the lengths to which Treasury Secretary Geithner in particular went to protect Citigroup as the crisis unfolded. Did he do more than you think was necessary to serve the public interest?
Well, I do, and I think Tim he always did what he thought was right. But yes, in 2009, the banking system was stable, and I think we should have taken much stronger action to get Citigroup restructured, get its bad assets off its balance sheet, replace management. There were some changes to the board which were positive and some management changes, but I think we should have done a lot more there. And it was important not only to clean up the bank so it would be in a better position to lend to support the real economy, but it was also there just needed to be some accountability. And there really hasn't been an accountability. And in 2009, the system was stable, and that was when we really should have been asking all banks to get rid of their toxic assets, restructure the mortgages, take the losses, and get on with it. And we just never did that. We propped them up with TARP capital. We did force them to raise new non-government sources of capital through the stress testing process, and I do think that was very positive and something where the Obama administration in particular deserves due credit. But the other part of that, getting the banks to take losses, restructure the mortgages, clean up their balance sheets, we just never did it.
Sheila Bair, my special guest on WNYC, former FDIC chairman, now the author of Bull by the Horns, Fighting to Save Main Street from Wall Street and Wall Street from Itself, as we talk in the context of Issue 12, Wall Street and Inequality, in our 30 Issues in 30 Days presidential election series. Ken in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Sheila Bair. Hello.
Yes, I've got two questions. The first is, how much of the crisis was due to banks being required to loan money to poor people versus banks writing derivatives and mislabeling the loans that they made to poor people?
Right.
And then the second question that I'd like to ask is, when my health insurer has access to all of my health records and my car insurer has access to my driving records, when a bank writes a new loan, why do they not simply upload the data to the FDIC when during the crisis people kept saying, we don't know who owes who, we don't know, we don't know? Mm-hmm. Banks never miss a credit card payment when I send it in. How could they not know who these loans were to? Why
Interesting.
Don't you just keep track?
Ken, thank you very much. So to his first question, I think it's right on point of our theme of inequality. Did this crisis begin to any degree, in your opinion, as a side effect of the government trying to reduce inequality by making more home loans to poor people?
No, I think expanding access to housing among the low-income folks was a rationalization, and a cynical one at that. But this was generated by greed. The government didn't force all of these mortgage originators and securitizers to take all these millions of dollars in fees and pay and bonuses just to help poor people. I know that's out there. But I just don't think it's right. It was a rationalization, but it wasn't the driver. Making a lot of money up front by originating very poor loans that were going to default later on, that is what drove this crisis. And I think Wall Street bears equal blame with the GSEs. The GSEs made tons of money off of this, too, by buying these Wall Street securities that, for a time, paid very generous premiums with, 9-10% starter rates. That's a pretty high-yielding mortgage-backed security. So I do think, the sad thing about this, too, is most of the subprime, they were not expanding home ownership. Those were refinancings. So many people who got these subprime loans had safe 30-year fixed-rate FHA mortgages, which they refinanced out of into these toxic adjustable-rate subprime loans, which later blew up in their faces. So I thank the caller for asking that question, because I think this has been suggested that Wall Street somehow did all this at the government's behest, and we forced them to take all this money that they made just to help poor people. It's just not right. It was greed that drove this, and unfortunately, I think a culture of greed still permeates a lot of the operations at some of our nation's financial institutions. So I do think that is something that needs to be clarified. In terms of the data, the credit cards, I do think the process called securitization drove this. Most of these mortgages were not originated by traditional banks that the FDIC insured. There were some banks and thrifts that the FDIC insured that originated them, but most of them were outside of the banking sector. They were done by mortgage brokers or mortgage bankers that did not have FDIC insurance, and then the mortgages were sold to Wall Street firms that were also not FDIC-backed, who again packaged them into securities and sold them off to investors. Credit cards are all, you have to have a bank as an issuer of a credit card, so you are going to have good data on credit card payments, because that is within the traditional banking system. But mortgages can be originated by anybody. That was one of the problems. We had very little, there were no national standards to register mortgage brokers and mortgage originators and making sure they had adequate training and were subject to regulation. We didn't have any of that. Anybody could originate a mortgage pretty much, and through securitization they could get funding to do that. A lot of that's been improved now. We have the Consumer Protection Bureau, which does have authority over non-bank mortgage originators, and we do have registration standards now and some system to regulate them and examine them. So going forward, hopefully that will perform better. But leading up to the crisis, we did not.
Bill in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Sheila Bair. Hi, Bill.
Hi there. I just wanted to know, when they changed the bankruptcy law and basically said that you couldn't basically discharge all of your debts,
right,
was that a contributory factor to the banks issuing wildly large credit limits to people and causing them basically to think, well, I've got a house that has some value in it, and I'll just use my credit card and use my house as my backup?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting how that change in the bankruptcy code might have changed behavior and relaxed lending standards, because the lender would think, well, they can't discharge this debt in bankruptcy, so I'll still be able to press repayment. There was an effort to try to get the bankruptcy law fixed so that you could, if you went into bankruptcy, you could get your loan restructured, and those efforts failed. And some think that could have been a helpful part of the solution here, because a lot of these mortgages still are just out there. They're not being dealt with. People are underwater. They don't have affordable payments, and there's no process effectively to deal with
that. So that making it harder to file for individual bankruptcy, which happened in the Clinton years,
right,
exacerbated inequality?
Well, I think that's a fair question to ask. Yes, if you make it more difficult for a person to discharge mortgage debt in bankruptcy, that is going to give lenders more incentives to make to loosen their lending standards because they know that debt cannot be discharged. So, I do think that was a factor, absolutely. And again, there were efforts to try to get that changed, and they failed. So it's, I think overall looking at what institutions' economic incentives were that led up to this subprime crisis, it's helpful to look at how the economic incentives align to really provide overwhelming and powerful forces that originated just, millions of these loans up front, again, because you were selling them off to investors, and so you didn't have to worry about whether they would blow up later on. And maybe the investors are more sanguine because that debt could not be discharged.
And again, the power of the banks influencing policy in a way that
they were very supportive
got
of that
more Americans to take on more debt. Credit card debt as well as housing debt, and we see the result. So in the context of this year's presidential race, which this conversation is taking place in, let me play for you a clip of Obama on regulating the banks and a clip of Romney. First, the president from this year's State of the Union address.
And I will not go back to the days when Wall Street was allowed to play by its own set of rules. The new rules we passed restore what should be any financial system's core purpose: getting funding to entrepreneurs with the best ideas and getting loans to responsible families who want to buy a home or start a business or send their kids to college. So if you are a big bank or financial institution, you're no longer allowed to make risky bets with your customers' deposits. You're required to write out a living will that details exactly how you'll pay the bills if you fail, because the rest of us are not bailing you out ever again.
President Obama from this year's State of the Union address. Now here's Governor Romney on CBS 60 Minutes answering a question last month from Scott Pelley.
You would roll back regulation on Wall Street?
Well, my view is you have to have regulation, and you have to make sure that there are rules for what kind of capital has to stand behind each kind of asset on Wall Street and in banks. You also have to make sure that these derivative trades are more transparent. You have to have extensive regulation.
On the things that got the country into trouble.
Absolutely. But what you can't do is put in place, as the president did, a more than 2,000-page bill. So far, there's some 8,000 pages of regulation that have been written. That's only 30% done. This has put such a chilling effect on small and regional banks that they're having a hard time doing the kind of action that gets people into new homes, writes new mortgages, gives loans to small business. I would try and rewind some of these, or unwind, rather, some of these extensive regulations on the local banks, the community banks. I want to help community and small banks stay in business and be able to renegotiate the loans and initiate new loans that the market needs.
Mitt Romney with Scott Pelley on 60 Minutes last month. We heard the president from the State of the Union address before that. My guest is former FDIC Chairman Sheila Bair with her new book, Bull by the Horns, in the context of our 30 Issues in 30 Days presidential election series. So, Ms. Bair, how much do you agree with Romney that Dodd-Frank regulates smaller banks too much, as he said in that clip? Is that a concern, or is that a distraction from the main issue of the big banks?
Well, I think there's a little bit of both in that. It's common when large institutions want to roll back regulation, they say, oh, you're going to be hurting the small banks. So I do think that people need to heavily scrutinize those kinds of statements. Dodd-Frank has a lot of exemptions and protections for smaller financial institutions, recognizing that they weren't the driver of this crisis. That said, though, some of the regulators have been cutting a pretty wide swath with their regulations, and I think some of the regulations that have been proposed do inadvertently or not, or unnecessarily, layer reg burden on smaller banks. And I do think that is unnecessary, and I do wish that the regulators would better prioritize and really promulgate and finalize the regulations that are necessary to address risk-taking by the large, complex financial institutions. Community banks did not drive this crisis. They already have very high capital levels because they are small enough to fail, so investors demand higher capital of them. And they weren't involved in all these servicing abuses, and they weren't involved with all these bad mortgages being originated. Yet a lot of the rules being proposed do impact them on how they service loans, how they originate loans. So I do think a better job could be done by a lot of the regulators in insulating the smaller banks from these rules.
And
but it is cynical to suggest that that's what Dodd-Frank is about. It's not. Dodd-Frank really went out of its way to protect small banks, and I do wish the regulators would do a better job of recognizing that.
And in the Obama clip, he said banks are now required to have a living will for how
That's
to unwind
right.
their assets if they get into trouble. Do you like that provision, and does it really mean that no bank, big bank that gets into trouble will be deemed too big to fail?
I do like that provision, and I worked very hard to get that underway before I left. And we do have the first submissions of living wills. They were submitted in July. And so I think that's a very positive thing. I do think the tools are there in Dodd-Frank to end too big to fail, to make sure we never again have taxpayer bailouts. But again, we need to have regulators in these jobs who believe and care about regulation, and we'll make that a priority. I do worry at times, as I said in this book, and I had repeated philosophical disagreements with Tim Geithner, that too often, I think the president is very sincere, but too often some of his economic team did tend to view the world through the eyes of very large financial institutions. And I think that's that is dangerous. Their interests are not our interest, and we do need to have a very strong, independent regulatory policy that applies to them.
We have about 3 minutes left. Let me get some quick takes from you on some quick questions, starting with how much you're a fan of a few items. Are you a fan of the Occupy Wall Street movement with their focus on inequality in America?
Well, I talked with them, and I think they've got a lot of very smart people. Some people used to be in the industry. They do a good job of filing comment letters and weighing into the rulemaking process. Where I think they need to focus more is on grassroots organizing. I think that's the problem with getting financial reform done is not just with the regulatory community and the need to make sure we have very strong, independent regulators, but we also need the Hill to be supportive, the Congress to be supportive of reform, and sometimes members of Congress put pressure on regulators not to reform. So I do think that that is an area where, frankly, the group on the right has been more effective in terms of the grassroots organization.
And how much are you a fan of Ben Bernanke's latest quantitative easing, buying $40 billion, just so people know what it is, $40 billion a month in mortgage securities? How much do you think it will do for the housing market or the economy generally?
Right. Well, I'm very skeptical. You know, so much of these policies and our economic recovery, you know, if you look even the past few years, so much of the economic recovery has been skewed towards upper income people. And the banks, right? So the bailout policies are very successful in getting them profitable again, but maybe not so much the broader economy. And I do fear that this latest round of quantitative easing, though I think well-intentioned to try to provide more juice for an economic recovery, it really, you know, the big bank stocks all went up after that was announced. And, you know, if you have a large international organization, you can take cheap money here and invest it overseas and get higher returns. You can make a profit that way. You can make short-term trading profits with the volatility that is created every time the Fed makes these types of announcements. And so I do think that this is another situation where, even though the intention of the policy is to benefit the broader economy, it's really it helps the larger financial institutions, the smaller ones that have to make loans for a living. They don't have these big trading books, so they need to lend if they're going to make a living. It's difficult for them because they get very low returns on their loans, and they're trying to lend in an uncertain economy. So I wish I know the intentions are good. And if I thought it was going to help the economy, I'd say go, Ben, notwithstanding the risks that it poses. Mm. But I just don't see the evidence at this point. And I think really our problems are fiscal in nature, and the Congress and the president are the ones that need to deal with them.
Any reaction to the story in the news today, the New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman's new suit against J.P.
Right.
Morgan Chase over Bear Stearns, which they now right. own, allegedly bilking investors in risky mortgage securities before the crisis?
Right. Well, I'm glad that's finally underway. It was announced some time ago, and I assume this will be the first of several. And certainly there needs to be some accountability. But I would also like to see the individuals, not just at the trader level as well as the executive level, the individuals who oversaw this and let this happen, I would like to see more suits brought against them personally as well. I think there hasn't been much personal accountability here, and the suits against the corporations are fine. But that's the corporate money pays for those, and it would be nice to see individuals sued more and make them pay out of their pocket or maybe even go into jail in cases of fraud. That's really where I'd like to see a more emphasis in the enforcement effort.
Final thing. In April, you wrote in the Washington Post what you called a modest proposal to fix
yes.
inequality
right.
with just a tweak to the Fed's easy money policy. Give every American a $10 million loan. And I know you wrote that with a wink, but what were you getting at?
Well, I think it gets back to the zero interest monetary policies. It provides cheap money for large financial institutions. Not just banks, hedge funds do this too. They can take cheap money here and reinvest it overseas, where you get higher rates and make a nice profit. So I was just suggesting, well, the Fed should give us all $10 million loans, and we can take it with zero interest rate, and we can take our $10 million and reinvest it in Spanish debt or Greek debt or whatever, and make a couple million a year. Given the high rates of return, and everybody would be happy. So it was tongue in cheek, but it just I just tried to underscore the fact that this is what's called the carry trade, and these very accommodative monetary policies that facilitate this kind of trading, and it just lines people's pockets. It doesn't really add to economic growth or recovery. So I do, and I know probably the Fed was upset with me when I wrote that, but I do wish there would be some harder thinking about who is really benefiting by these near zero interest rate policies. I think early on when we were in a crisis, the Fed did need to pump a lot of liquidity into the system, but now I just see it generating trading profits. Mm-hmm. I don't see a lot of real economic growth coming from it, and I think the inflation risks are substantial.
But it does imply a serious question, which is why couldn't the government have bailed out the borrowers rather than the lenders, put the liquidity in the hands
right.
of struggling
well,
homeowners
right.
who are the ones who were failing
yeah,
to make their mortgage payments and let them trickle up to the banks?
Well, that's right. And the losses to the banks were being caused because the mortgages were going bad. And as you said earlier in this program, we had hundreds of billions of losses on mortgages, but we had trillions of losses based on derivatives and these complex derivative products that were based on how the mortgages performed. And so if we'd fixed the mortgages, it should have gone up, not down. And instead, we did a trickle-down approach to try to fix the banks and hope the rest of it would take care of itself. And that just doesn't work. And the housing market is still, I'm glad it's coming back a bit, but there's just still a lot of distressed loans out there, and there's no effective program to deal with them. And that was something I was pushing in 2007. We were trying to get those loans restructured, and people just weren't listening, and I'm afraid still. And when it comes to homeowner relief, the government's response has been very timid.
Sheila Bair, her new book is called Bull by the Horns. Right? Is that the name of the book?
Yes, Bull by the Horns.
Right. And I see on the book jacket you are identified as the former FDIC chairman. Did you make a conscious decision at some point? Like, you go with a gender-neutral chair.
Oh, I know. People ask about that. I will tell you, I had an environmental reason for sticking with chairman. We had a lot of stationery and signage with the word chairman on it, office of the chairman, and so I just decided to leave it alone. And perhaps I should have gone to chairwoman. But I do ask that people do not call me Chair Bear, because maybe that sounds a little bit too much like Care Bear. I don't know. But chairman or chairwoman, or actually I prefer Sheila the most.
The history of feminism is told through the office stationery budget. Sheila Bair, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, our 30 Issues in 30 Days series. Up next, Paul Taylor from Pew will explain the march of inequality by the numbers. For example, how the rich got richer in 2011, but the median American income decline. Stay with us.
If we choose to keep those tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires, or for hedge fund managers and corporate jet owners, or for oil and gas companies pulling in huge profits without our help, then we'll have to make even deeper cuts somewhere else.
President Obama, with one of his standard campaign lines that plays on the problem of inequality but gets criticized by Republicans as class warfare, here is a famous or infamous Mitt Romney moment that responds to Obama. Matt Lauer from The Today Show asks the question.
Are there no fair questions about the distribution of wealth?
I think it's fine to talk about those things in quiet rooms and discussions about tax policy and the like. But the president has made this part of his campaign rally. Everywhere we go or he goes, we hear him talking about millionaires and billionaires and executives and Wall Street. And it's a very envy-oriented, attack-oriented approach, and I think it'll fail.
Inequality, said Romney, should be discussed in quiet rooms. It is 30 issues in 30 days as we continue a full week on the topic of inequality as an issue in the presidential campaign. On financial inequality, the Census Bureau reported that the U.S. income gap grew last year, concentrating more wealth at the top, while the middle class sank and the poor stagnated. As the New York Times wrote it up, incomes rose last year for the top 20% of earners by about 1.5%, according to the Census Bureau, with even larger increases for the top 5%. But for the typical American family, not so good. The median income fell to $50,000. That's 8% less than in 2007. Incomes for the poor remained about the same. And according to the Pew Research Center, the middle class has been gradually shrinking for the last 40 years, down from about 60% of the population in the early 1970s to about 50% of us today. With that, let's take a quick but closer look at inequality in America by the numbers with Paul Taylor from the Pew Research Center, author of a report that came out in August called The Lost Decade of the Middle Class. Thanks for coming on, Paul. Welcome to WNYC. Can we start with that stat I just cited, the 40-year shrinkage in the percentage of Americans who are middle class? Can you expand on that stat?
Sure. That was our dive into census data over 40 years. We correct it for inflation. We correct it for changes in household size. So we do our best to make it an apples-to-apples comparison of one decade or one year to the next. We impose an arbitrary boundary of middle class. We impose lots of different boundaries, but we settled on the one that comes closest to how Americans self-define as class. And we said, let's look at the share of the public today whose household income falls between two-thirds and twice the national median. And if you impose those boundaries today, you get 51% of the public, of all households, falling in that middle. If you impose the exact same boundaries on the public 40 years ago, you would have gotten 61% falling in that middle. So that we think is a apples-to-apples comparison. There are fewer people in the middle. Now, where did they go? Some went below the middle and some went above the middle. And that distribution in terms of households and people over the last 40 years is fairly equal. About the same number drifted down as climbed up. From a point of view of if you believe in income, that income inequality is a bad thing, you would say, well, that's pretty good news. And in some ways it is. But the second part of that analysis, when you ask where the money went, yes, there's a slightly larger share above double the national median, but all of the money went there. So if you look at the share of the money that the folks in the middle are capturing now versus 40 years ago, it's a much smaller share, and it's a much smaller share for those at the bottom, and it's a much, much larger share for those at the top.
So a lot more of the income today goes to people at the top, and a lot more of the wealth that people own is concentrated at the top. So are we gradually becoming Latin America?
I wouldn't say we're gradually becoming Latin America, but we are gradually becoming somewhat less equal than we used to be. This gets pretty technical. There's something called the Gini coefficient, which measures income inequality. With zero, it goes from zero to one. It's a simple measure. Zero would be perfect equality in a society. Everybody in a society has exactly the same share of the national income. One would be perfect inequality. Just one person in the society has all of the income. And we, over these last 30 or 40 years, have moved up that scale. We're now at about 0.7. We're now at about nearly exactly in the middle. That makes us very high on national on international comparisons, and it's higher than we used to be. 30 or 40 years ago, we were at about 0.42. So we've drifted up by about 17-18%. You can actually put a number on it.
What are some countries near us now?
I think we are more unequal than all of the countries that are most similar to us. That is to say, you know, Western Europe, all of the advanced economies of Western Europe. I think we're very near the top on that scale. And we are probably similar to some of the countries we associate with great, great inequality, such as perhaps some of the Latin American countries.
In your August poll, 62% blame Congress for the decline of the middle class. 54%, the next largest number, blamed Wall Street. What would the experts say about that compared to the general public?
Well, you'll have to ask the experts. But that was a follow-up question. The question we asked preceding that on our survey was, all in all, would you say it's become easier or more difficult for the middle over the past decade for the middle class to maintain its standard of living? 85% of the public says it's become more difficult. And then we asked, well, who do you blame most? And we gave people, I think, six or seven different options, and the two you named, Congress and the big financial institutions. We also said, well, the Obama administration, the Bush administration, foreign competition, the middle class themselves. And the two you named were far and away the winners, the quote winners, the head of the rogue gallery. And this goes to a sense that the most of the middle class believes that this is a problem that has been imposed on them by big institutions, whether political or financial, that have failed them. When we gave them the option, how about the middle class themselves? And there are those who have made this argument. That's part of the problem we got into in the early aughts, was the bubble economy, was those housing prices that were going out of control, people borrowing against the inflated value of their homes, taking out loans they should have never taken out. But just 8% of the public blame the middle class themselves. So I think it's one of the reasons that this is a particularly tough and toxic political environment this year. Obviously, the Great Recession, the in effect for most families, the non-recovery of the Great Recession has given this sort of overhang of gloom and doom. And people think, you know what, this is something that's been done to us by institutions that have failed us.
Paul Taylor from the Pew Research Center, thank you so much for giving us some inequality by the numbers.
Thank you.
It is 30 Issues in 30 Days, the conclusion of Issue 12, Wall Street and You, in our week on inequality. Tomorrow, by the way, we'll talk about the very poor, what kind of safety net, what kind of trampoline. And on Thursday, a different kind of inequality. Are some Americans being asked for all the sacrifice with the country at war? Also, don't forget our collaboration with longform.org, which is providing some great articles for you to read on our website this week on the question of inequality. For example, Amber Waves of Green by Joe Ronson in GQ this summer, The Financial Life of Six American Men on Very Different Rungs of the Ladder, and Nickel and Dime, that's the original Barbara Ehrenreich Harper's article before the book from 1999. You can find the link to these longform.org articles on our 30 Issues page at wnyc.org/issues. And our 30 Issues segments all this week being produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, the architects who designed the Barclay Center take your first weekend user reviews on aesthetics and user-friendliness and talk about their vision for the arena. Stay with us.